think about the fact that ethics cannot just be some kind of system or rationale or even a set of reasons or an internalized law.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas, produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 6 of Damn the Absolute. Early in life, we learn rules for moral conduct. We are taught which actions are right and which ones are wrong. Eventually, we're able to grasp principles and closed systems that allege to hold in place the reasons for why any particular action has moral value. In philosophical terms, this might look like John Stuart Mill's utilitarian happiness principle. An action is right insofar as it maximizes utility or pleasure for the greatest number of people. It might resemble Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative, to act only according to a maxim whereby you can will at the same time that it should become a universal law. There's an assurance and comfort in having this sort of written stone approach to morality. A moral reality that is unchanged, universal, and enclosed in the structure of the universe. We just have to discover it, reason our way to it, and once we pen it to paper, we have moral laws we can always fall back on. This reliability and simplicity has its appeal, but what if closed moral systems are incomplete and wrong-headed? What if ethical living arises from a more ambiguous and ineffable place? What if we were instead to understand that the moral life is embedded in face-to-face interactions, that ethics is derived from a place of radical subjectivity and infinite responsibility to the other? Immanuel Levinas is a 20th century French philosopher who rejected this rules-based notion of morality. Informed by phenomenologists like Edmund Husserl and Martin Heidegger, Levinas champions a subjective approach to the ethical life that demands a constant vigilance and moral responsiveness from us. The face, as he calls it, is interruptive and constantly calling after us for attention. Levinas suggests an immense obligation to others that honestly seems inexhaustible, a moral demand that we'll probably never be able to satisfy. In her book, Levinas and James Toward a Pragmatic Phenomenology, Megan Craig offers us an overview of Levinas's ethics by positioning him alongside the pragmatist philosopher William James. She does this not only to introduce Americans to an otherwise opaque and challenging continental philosopher, but as a way of revealing the more practical or pragmatic elements of his ethics. She wants us to consider what might be a more creative and vitalizing approach to ethical living, a perspective that prioritizes lived experience over moral abstractions and detached laws. I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Megan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So I'd like to start out, it's a bit of a hazing activity at Damn the Absolute, but we want to highlight how wrong we could be about so many things. What's a view you've held as an adult you were pretty confident wouldn't change that's actually shifted dramatically for you?
Yeah, this is a very difficult question because I feel like I was pretty stubborn person in my youth with all of my views. But I think the one that's probably changed the most dramatically is the idea that babies and kids are products mostly of their environments and their caregivers. And definitely in having kids of my own, I no longer hold that view.
Yeah. Tell me more. How has that shifted? Or in what direction has that moved toward?
Well, I remember the very second that my first daughter was born, just being totally confounded by the fact that she was so fully a person of her own and just entirely there as a person. And so that really shifted. I think I had thought that parenthood was like the instilling of values and knowledge and all kinds of things into this kind of blank slate of a child. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I realized if anything, parenting was going to be a project of staying out of the way of this person who was already fully there and who I could only potentially mess up, but really can have very minimal role in molding into being something else.
As a non-parent, that jives with my own view, my sense. I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I feel like it's the child's going to be the child, and you just want to make sure you minimize as much harm or imposing trauma onto them as possible. And if you do that, you're probably in pretty good shape.
Yeah, I think so. And it was sort of, I mean, this redoubled when I had my second daughter, who was so drastically from birth different from my first daughter. So yeah, it's actually, I mean, it's been a wonderful realization because it kind of changes a lot of other worldviews that you don't realize you have, but that in fact were in place. But yeah, I now think of babies as the most brilliant creatures on earth and life as a kind of regrettable trajectory of losing your innate brilliance as you get older.
Well, I think as we talk about Emmanuel Levinas and his ethics, some of that may actually show up because I think that can mix in there with some of those viewpoints. So Emmanuel Levinas, I encountered him as an undergrad, and your experiences I was reading about resonated a little bit with my own. I believe I started with Totality and Infinity, and it was like very opaque and difficult. And so then I dropped it halfway through and found secondary sources to kind of help walk me through it and sort of walk through it. I had some philosophy professors who really appreciated Levinas. In your experience, you wrote about how, I think it was your first encounter, you described as you tapped into a semi-articulate but firm sense of the importance of looking in the eye, that Levinas is about a kind of verbal silence. Can you talk a bit more about that in your first encounters with Levinas?
So I was doing my undergraduate work at Yale University, and there happened to be a grad student there at the time who gave a seminar on Levinas, even though that was really not any part of the kind of core curriculum in the philosophy department at that time. And really at that time, Levinas was not a major figure, or at least wasn't being read in a lot of philosophy courses in the United States. So that was just a kind of fortuitous chance meeting. And I think there were a couple of things about it. I mean, I found it incredibly hard to read Levinas when I first encountered Totality and Infinity and all of these essays that we were looking at. But there was something kind of rhythmic about the prose and a sort of suspension of disbelief required to get through some of that reading that really felt actually quite natural for me and felt like real work. So I really liked that feeling of having to work hard at this philosopher. And then I think in my first blush kind of encounter with Levinas, that sense of face-to-face that's so prevalent in Totality and Infinity kind of tapped into what I think of now as like a very natural aspect of my own upbringing and the kind of focus on a sort of morality that's like, be a good person, do your best, look the other person in the eye, honesty, integrity, like this whole matrix of stuff. And I think as a kid, I really did have the feeling that if you really look at a person, that something important transpires, whether it's that you find out something more about them or you're expressing your feeling toward them, or even the possibility of forestalling some kind of bad turn of events by really looking at a person, which is not to say I ever actually had that experience of, you know, like looking a bully in the eye and then not getting bullied or something. But I think that was always a kind of deep hope I had through childhood. And so, and anyway, initially the Levinas's use of that expression face to face just coincided with my own very much kind of lived experience of what I think morality kind of looks like.
Yeah, I can attest to some of that. I've really tried to make more of a focus of making eye-to-eye contact. I know as we get into Levinas, when he talks about the face, that's not exactly what's going on there, what he's really talking about. But there's this ethics that he's evoked by really kind of seeing the other person. And I've found that more and more as I'm trying to, rather than just look in their direction, is like, let me see your face, let you see mine, and let's see what comes out of that. And you do feel that call come to you more. So with Levinas, could you give us a little bit of an introduction to his biography, a little bit more of who he was?
To knit back into the last question you asked, I think it is important to say that that was my naive first reading of Levinas. But yeah, Levinas really does not mean that ethics is as simple as looking the other person in the eye. So that is important to stress at the beginning. So who is Levinas? So Levinas was a 20th century philosopher, Jewish philosopher, originally from Lithuania. He was born in 1906. And he studied philosophy in Germany and also in France. He became a naturalized French citizen and then is kind of, he wrote in French. And so he is associated with French and with his French nationality. And that's a very important part of his biography. Philosophically, you know, I think it's important to note that he studied very early on in his life with Husserl and with Heidegger. And those are the two kind of figures who made a really huge impact on him as a young up-and-coming philosopher. He was also best friends with Maurice Blanchot. And that is another really important both personal and philosophical kind of connection in Levinas's life. And yeah, there's so many important things to know about him, but because he had French citizenship, he ended up serving as a translator in the French army during the Second World War and had a certain amount of protection via his French citizenship status. So while most of his family in Lithuania were sent to concentration camps during that time period, Levinas was sent to a labor camp for French officers, and he was captured in 1940, and he spent several years in that labor camp. And that's the time in which he really drafted the text of his first published book. So I think you and I are probably going to talk more about the relationship between that time period and his philosophy, but that it's an interesting aspect of his biography that he really started writing kind of the core of his adult, mature philosophical works in captivity.
It brings to mind, I hadn't thought of this before, but I think of Viktor Frankl, who while he was in a concentration camp during World War II, he was writing, like sneaking notes of paper to write his book, Man's Search for Meaning, and working through logotherapy. And so that was another story that comes to mind, is amazing, not only withstanding those difficult circumstances, but to produce such insightful work that is so well read, at least with Viktor Frankl. Levinas, not quite as well read, but maybe just as much as deserving of that attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's important always to consider the historical biographical situation of thinkers, and especially when you have work emanating from such a crucible, to be adequately informed and sensitive to what it means to think out of those lived circumstances.
What are some of the ways in which you think his time as a prisoner of war influenced Levinas's ethics and his philosophy in general?
Yeah, so it's a huge question. I think there, you know, we could talk all day just about this one thing. So concretely, in that first book, which is called Existence and Existence, where the first existence is E-N-C-E, and the second one is E-N-T-S, there's a lot of themes that emerge in that book that seem to be directly related to Levinas's experience of captivity. So the kind of focus on insomnia and on labor and on isolation and on the kind of hope of sociality, but in the absence of the experience of a social world, and also a kind of thinking about escape and what escape could mean or what it looks like. So I think those things kind of underpin a lot of Levinas's thinking. And I think the experience of the Second World War and the Holocaust is the necessary backdrop for trying to understand Levinas's project as a whole, which is really, you know, it's a project that is on the one hand really critical of a kind of enlightenment sensibility that human subjects become increasingly rational and reasonable and free and autonomous, and it's out of the kind of full package of rational autonomy, that we then treat each other in certain ways and live in a just and equitable world. And it's not that the Second World War was the first or the only indicator that that is a false and deeply utopian picture. But I think, you know, for Levinas, this really became the kind of crisis out of which he was able to think about the fact that ethics cannot just be some kind of system or rationale or even a set of reasons or an internalized law, like the kind of Kantian categorical imperative, but really has to be thought about in the fraught and constantly shifting, changing context of experiences of people doing unimaginable things to one another. So that, I think, is really the kind of necessary landscape to be thinking about Levinas within.
Most of the time with ethics, especially as an extension of growing out of the Enlightenment, we think of ethics as being principle-based, a moral rule system, and we have those, and those are these sort of universal, unchanging things that can anchor and guide our activity. And yet Levinas contrasts with that, where he's really trying to, he has this really radical ethical subjectivity, and he's really resistant to these rule-based ethics. Why does he resist that so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, if we go back to, you know, just Kant as kind of one figure who sort of epitomizes this Enlightenment commitment to reason and rationality, in Kant, the idea of the categorical imperative is that you sort of give yourself a law, you internalize a law, which has to do with kind of asking yourself, would I universalize this action? In anything that you're thinking about doing, ask yourself, would you want everybody everywhere to do the same thing? And if the answer is no, then it's probably not a good idea to proceed. And so the sort of rubric for that kind of ethics is tied to a kind of mastery over oneself and over, you know, whether it's a formal system or whether it's a single kind of categorical imperative. The Ten Commandments has a similar kind of shape where, you know, as long as you know them and you know them well and you keep them in mind, you're meant to pretty much stay out of trouble. But I think Levinas, you know, he's reacting to the fact that in historically, and especially historically in Nazi Germany, you have a very rational, reasonable, coherent set of actors who are devising all kinds of laws and all kinds of norms and doing it in incredibly detailed, meticulous, rational discourse. And all of it is geared toward the extermination of groups of people. So there's no necessary link between reason, rationality, law, and principle, and ethics. And Levinas is, I think, on the one hand, pointing out that you don't just take one and get the other, but that in fact, when we rely on this kind of rule-based, principle-based conception of ethics, we relinquish responsibility. We allow ourselves to indulge in a kind of, you know, a kind of forgetfulness and a kind of laziness that is really at odds with what genuine ethics calls for.
I think it really presents a profound pushback against, for lack of a better term, like a technocratic morality, where it's like, well, here's the system, you put in these inputs, and here's what it tells me what to do. And you can, like you said, just push off your responsibility from this very deeply unsettling place that Levinas is trying to bring us to. Levinas doesn't really offer many specific concrete examples of what an ethical activity is or should look like beyond after you saying hello to someone, opening the door. What are the most concrete examples that he can offer us in regards to helping us to know what is the ethical way of living?
Yeah, so I mean, this is an aspect of Levinas that I've looked at a lot and I like a lot because it brings together what I like to think of as the minimalist and the maximalist aspects of his thinking. So there are basically two examples that he ever gives for ethical action. And one you just mentioned is the after you, sir, or holding the door open so that another person can go in ahead of you. that's like the minimalist part of Levinas that I really love, because it's such a minimal kind of gesture that's really just rooted in decency and manners. It's also incredibly easy to forget, especially if you're in a hurry or you've had a bad day, or there could be any number of reasons why you don't hold the door open for somebody. But Levinas kind of reminds us of the cumulative effect of these very minimal kinds of gestures. On the maximalist side of things, the one commandment that he routinely invokes is the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill.
Mm.
So, you know, I think there's a really interesting way in which he brings together the thou shalt not kill with hold the door, and shows us that these seemingly insignificant moments of confrontation or togetherness with other human beings are in fact immensely significant, because it's when we forget or overlook doing those doable, simple things that we often find ourselves in situations that are ultimately violent and bring us face to face with the sixth commandment. Yeah, so I think that that's a really interesting part of Levinas. I think he also deliberately distances himself from creating some kind of litany of specific examples, because one of his broader points is that ethics cannot be delivered to you as a how-to manual. And he really struggles with this problem because, of course, as soon as you're writing, there's a kind of prescriptive aspect to writing as soon as it's on the page. And I think, you know, he's always struggling with that and trying to kind of undo the potentially prescriptive aspects of his text. And that's very tricky, but he works hard to do it. That is what gives some of his prose such a convoluted and difficult style.
As we're trying to become more ethical people, what guidance can Levinas offer us to maybe heighten our ethical sensibilities, to at least give us a notion that we're on the right track, that we're becoming a more ethically obligated person? What are some guideposts one of us could look for? Because if I'm not looking able to sort of, if you'll check a box, I'm like, oh, yep, I'm sort of in line with this principle, or I'm doing this prescriptive thing, how can I know that I'm really fulfilling or doing my best to fulfill my commitment to the other person?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I think so many people who read Levinas just find it infuriating and hopeless. And hopeless in part because the kind of demand of ethical responsibility that Levinas describes is so heavy, and it's so unending and unyielding. And so you can really come away from Levinas feeling like, I'm never doing enough. I will never do enough. It's sort of hopeless from the beginning. And I think there's a way in which, you know, the answer to your question is you'll never know. There will not be some revelatory moment when you get your angel wings, or you finally feel like you've gotten the gold medal in ethics, or have grown up, or had some kind of sure sign that you are on the right track. And I think that that's a difficult message to hear, because there's so much uncertainty involved in that view of ethics. But I think that's a really important and interesting aspect of what Levinas is doing, because if ethics is not this kind of project of self-betterment, you know, we're just inundated with all these kind of products for self-improvement these days in one form or another. But that's really not how Levinas sees ethics. It's not just a kind of cumulative, like do A, do B, do C, and the end of the day, ta-da, you're ethical. It really is a kind of project of starting over each time, in part because of the singularity of the other person you encounter and the kinds of demands and needs that emanate from another person. So just because you happened to do the right thing in case A doesn't mean that now you have a little playbook where in the same situation the next time you just go on autopilot and do that again, and it will all work out. And we all know that from experiences, I think, where we have tried that out to whatever effect. But you think, oh, I've been here before. I just do this thing, it'll work out. And then you're encountered with the particularity of a situation that really has no precedent. And the thing you thought would work isn't working. So in that way, the downside is that you can't know, there's no guarantee, and you don't just get more ethical. Keep holding the door, hold the door every time. You still may not wind up being ethical. But the positive side is that ethics really then becomes a kind of ongoing creative practice, which is a lot more interesting than these other accounts of ethics that would have you ultimately kind of lean back into what you've memorized or what you know or what you've done before.
Let's turn toward a couple key concepts in Levinas. The face is one that can become a tired or a caricatured concept for people who read Levinas. The face, when he talks about, he's not talking about the eyes, the skin, our lips, our mouth. He's talking about something else. So what is the face to Levinas and what is not the face?
Levinas, I mean, if you have heard anything about Levinas, you've probably heard the phrase face to face. And this is a really complicated moment in Levinas because I think it draws a lot of people in thinking that that does resonate with something intuitive in them about, like we were talking about earlier, looking a person in the eye or looking them face to face. That phrase is really prevalent in totality and infinity and becomes a lot less prevalent in subsequent writings of Levinas's. I think as he started to see that it was prone to caricature and this sort of reductive reading of his ethics, he has in a couple of places in interviews described this text by Vasily Grossman called Life and Fate, a Russian text. But in this text, which Levinas really loved, there is a description of a line of people who are waiting for food rations. So it's a sort of line of destitute, hungry people. And there's a description of the nape of the neck of somebody in that line. And Levinas repeatedly will go back to that example and say that the face is like the nape of the neck. And I think what he really means is that face is not just eyes, ears, nose, mouth, the frontal part of the head, but that face is an expressive zone of the human body, and face can transpire anywhere on the human body, and it's not predominantly a visual event. So it's not a matter of seeing the face or identifying a face as a face. It's more of an auditory or acoustic event where some aspect of the human body expresses anguish or need or is expressive in some way, and that is being registered by another person as urgent, meaningful expression. And that can really happen relative to, again, any part of the human body.
I know Levinas has referred to sculptures, Rodin, for example, and seeing the muscular tone of a body in a sculpture and that being the face as well. It's not even a lived person. To a lot of people encountering Levinas as we're trying to reach for familiar concepts to the face, I think it's common for a lot of people to think, is this the conscience, or is this something like the conscience? Is that a reasonable connection, or is that really confuse what Levinas is talking about?
So Levinas really is not a thinker of conscience in the way that I think in modern times we think about that term. And one way I guess I like to differentiate Levinas is by thinking about Heidegger a little bit on this issue, because in Being in Time, the call of conscience is a really important phenomenon in Heidegger's thinking. So hearing the call of conscience for Heidegger is one way of facing up to an authentic possibility of being. So by hearing the call of conscience, I'm brought back to myself and made to face myself. And this becomes a really pivotal kind of authenticating moment in Being in Time. I think Levinas is very critical of that kind of mode of authenticity in Heidegger, in part because it remains internal to the subject. So it's sort of like this echo chamber of my conscience calling me back to myself, to be my best self, to be the best version of myself. And I think he really sees that whole project of authenticity in Heidegger as a very egoistic, insular kind of project. So against the backdrop of that, you have Levinas, who, if there is any intimation of conscience in Levinas, it's the fully embodied, personified version of that voice in another person. So conscience is not the internal voice that I have in my head. It's explicitly the voice of the other person who I'm now facing. So there's no kind of ricocheting mirror chamber quality to conscience in Levinas. And like I said, it's not a word that he employs, and really his stress is always on what he calls the other.
It really echoes what you were saying earlier about, and I'm going to call out the self-help life hacker genre of what can I do to become the best self, the best person? How is this going to come back to, like you said, me being the most authentic person, coming into attunement with being, et cetera. And it really is reversing the way we view phenomenology. So Levinas comes from a phenomenologist tradition, really tends to start from the ego inward and goes outward. And Levinas is flipping that around, saying we really, you look at the other and then you come inward to yourself.
Yeah, there is a whole different kind of stress in Levinas, and it's a different sense of subjectivity and what it means to be a subject, because Levinas really is a great thinker of subjectivity. It's just not subjectivity as we are used to encountering it, which is often as this progressive project of autonomy and freedom and becoming more myself. With Levinas, the account of subjectivity and what it means to be a subject really begins with the calling out of the subject by virtue of this interaction with another person, which is being called off-center and being called out of yourself, being called to be different rather than being called to be more of who you already are.
I'd like to step over to another concept related to this that is central to Levinas, and you'll have to pardon my lack of French. Is this pronounced Ilya?
Ilya, yeah, that was good.
So what is the concept of Ilya, and what does that mean in Levinas's ethics?
I love that you're only asking me easy questions.
Levinas is a very difficult philosopher, so I'm glad you find these to be easier questions.
I'm totally joking. Yeah, so the Ilya is another major concept of Levinas's. And like with face, it kind of employs really simple, ubiquitous language to begin to do something very complicated and far-reaching in his philosophy. So face is not a complicated word. It's not a word that's sort of charged philosophically from the beginning. And Ilya in French is just the kind of ordinary, everyday way in which you'd say there is. The phrase that Levinas uses most often in order to express the Ilya is il pleut, which just means it rains, or il fait beau, it's nice out. So again, this very kind of minimalist, ordinary bit of language, which for Levinas is actually expressive of something existential. And that is the fact that existence rumbles on or continues irrespective of any singular or personal attachment or commitment or subject or object. So there's a really nice interview where Levinas is asked about the Ilya, and he says he really associates the Ilya with his experience as a kid of being put to bed upstairs and then lying awake in the dark and having the realization that stuff was still going on downstairs. So even though he's about to fall asleep, he can hear his parents rustling about, he can hear stuff happening. And I think for a child, you know, you sort of think, well, when I go to sleep, everything stops. So my world is just, I'm at the center of it. And when I'm awake, that's when there's the world. And when I go to sleep, everything goes to sleep with me. But the Ilya expresses that kind of, you know, slightly terrifying or nauseating feeling that nothing stops and that you are not at the center of all of existence, that even though you may have fallen asleep or even though you may not have been aware or you were not present or any number of other things that might happen that take you out of the kind of centrality of the scene of life, life is going on. And so Ilya expresses that, and Levinas always talks about it as being impersonal and ambiguous. And this is also in opposition to the German phrase that Heidegger uses so much, which is es gibt, which is the there is in German. So you have Ilya in French and es gibt in German. But of course, es gibt translated literally has this connotation of giving, and so sort of generosity of existence, whereas Levinas in the Iliad is really thinking along much more neutral kind of flattened terrain. Existence is not generous. It's not there for you. It's not personalized in any way. There's this deep anonymity to existence. And for Levinas, what's really miraculous is that against the ongoing backdrop of this impersonal existence, the Iliad, subjects nonetheless articulate themselves.
In attempting to use a more familiar but incredibly baggage term to understand Ilya, I think it wouldn't be unreasonable for someone to reach for the concept of God, or maybe a more mystical notion of God in some sense. Is there any way in which that's a reasonable way to connect Levinas' thought and Ilya for people, or is that really just out there in left field?
I mean, I think the temptation is always to basically take any ambiguous term and render it mystical and potentially religious, and that can have a consoling effect, like there's agency here, or there's something ultimately positive here. But one of the things that's really difficult with Levinas, I appreciate so much, is the commitment to staying in the midst of the ambiguous, the commitment to this kind of neutrality, this term of Iliad as a term of neutrality. So it is not personified. It's not a source of salvation. It's not ultimately anything. It's the experience that we're not confronted with nothing. We're confronted with something. Something's going on, even when we're not aware of or conscious of or attentive to it. But that something that's going on, just like il pleut, it rains, is totally neutral. It can't be invested with the kind of spiritual value that some kind of mysticism or God would do for that concept without changing it altogether into something else.
Levinas is a Jewish thinker. Is it fair to understand him as also a religious or atheistic thinker as well?
So there is a lot of scholarship on this topic, and Levinas was known as a great reader of the Talmud and has published Talmudic readings and studied with very important Talmudic teacher for a very long time. And so his both personal and professional investment in Judaism is incredibly deep. And yeah, I think it's entirely fair to read him as a religious thinker. But I think that one of the really compelling parts of the Judaic aspects of his philosophy is in the commitment to the here and now, and in the idea that the transcendence is not kind of over and beyond the life that we encounter and are in the midst of living, but that it's a kind of deepening of the place in which we find ourselves and the commitment to other people.
It was actually some religious professors or religiously inclined professors who turned me on to Levinas originally, and I think there's this thing that happens in which Levinas is difficult enough to access and maybe ambiguous enough that if you come from a more religious background, you're going to reach for and see a lot more theistic or religious viewpoints in there than he may actually be intending or maybe justified. And if you're of a more atheistic bent, you may not see that way. And you're going to take the ambiguous stuff in a much more naturalized sense, perhaps. And as you put it, the here and now is what he's really focused on. I personally think he allows for that malleability to engage from either direction you want to, when really it just comes down to our obligations to one another and how that manifests in very particular, concrete, embodied, lived experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I have been criticized myself for trying to naturalize Levinas. So I feel a certain amount of sensitivity to this issue because I am not a religious person myself. And I think that especially in the Jewish tradition, the sense of, I don't know what I want to say here, but almost ownership of Levinas, or the sense of Levinas as being emblematic of something that is deeply religious, is very important. And that requires a lot of careful examination. But Levinas himself, in his interviews and in his own biographical writings, really emphasized a distinction between his philosophy and his religious views. And I think that's also worth taking seriously and being able to encounter his philosophy from a totally agnostic perspective. And you know, there's value in doing that, and then in also being sort of introduced to different aspects of his Judaism through his philosophy, which maybe then serves as a kind of interesting and surprising introduction for people who don't have a very strong sense of what Judaism might entail or include.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode. Levinas is a very European thinker, very continental European, wrote primarily in French. A lot of Americans aren't familiar with them. And in your book, Levinas and James, you are trying to position or maybe introduce Americans to Levinas through how he intersects with William James. Could you introduce us a little bit to who William James is and elaborate on what his radical empiricism means?
First of all, I didn't expect to be writing about Levinas and William James, but there is a really interesting moment in Levinas's book, Existence and Existence, which was published in 1947 and came out of those notes he took while he was in captivity, where he references William James. And I always thought it was really interesting that he would reference William James, especially knowing that he was in captivity and didn't have access to any of his books or no library. And yet that's one of the things that's on his mind. And it's a reference to William James's Principles of Psychology, where James writes about it's about the phenomenon of effort and how difficult it is to get from the moment of sitting up in bed and putting your foot down on the floor. The idea that there's a kind of infinite gap between those two things that can only be bridged by the phenomenon of effort. So I was so struck by the fact that Levinas referenced that. And so then I began to kind of dig into how much and whether there was actual historical connection between these two and what could be said about them. But James essentially, so to answer your question, so James was an American philosopher, and he's kind of known as the father of American psychology. So we're talking about the late 19th century, and James taught the first college level course on psychology ever in the United States at Harvard University, and his Principles of Psychology became the kind of landmark text in psychology. His radical empiricism is, so that's really the way in which James articulates his version of pragmatism. So James is often associated with American pragmatists and billed as one of the leading American pragmatists, but there's a lot of different kinds of pragmatism. So he really developed his radical empiricism around 1906 when he published this text called Essays in Radical Empiricism. And it's really a theory about experience that kind of aims to stress two things. So on the one hand, experiences themselves. And on the other hand, the relationship between experiences. So if you're trying to think about radical empiricism, you might think about it being similar to traditional kind of Humean empiricism in its stress on experience, but radical because of the way it wants to give conjunctions and relations an equal amount of reality to the experiences themselves. And I mean, just in kind of ordinary terms, one of the examples that James actually uses in the Principles of Psychology is the phrase, the pack of cards is on the table. So traditional empiricists would just focus on the kind of nouns and verbs in that sentence. The cards and table would be the really important empiricist aspects of that sentence. But James is emphatic that, in fact, it's not just the pack of cards is on the table, but it's the conjunction of all of those terms together. And so we never just have a pack of cards on the table. We have a pack of cards on a table in a specific room at a specific date and time. And you get this kind of halo of elaboration around every possible experience, object, or subject. And that's what's radical about radical empiricism.
So would it be fair to say that with empiricism, traditionally, everything is really broken down into atoms in a sense? There's all these just bits and pieces, and we don't really see the relationships. We just see these pieces. We passively receive them, but we're focusing on our senses, whereas a radical empiricism is also going to, in that same moment, see the full context or as much as is available and see those relationships at the same time that we're seeing those atoms and bits and pieces.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, James describes radical empiricism as what he calls a mosaic philosophy of plural facts. If you think about empiricism as kind of a jigsaw puzzle on the floor where all the pieces are just laid out, James's counter to that is the idea of a mosaic, where you still have a lot of little individual pieces, but the only way in which they're forming a mosaic is because they've been bonded together in different ways and are hanging together to make this larger picture, which is at once little bits of individual things and also the whole big thing together and the connecting pieces.
I want to get from James's radical empiricism and then his ethics to help bridge to Levinas's ethics. And there's a way in which we can understand pragmatist ethics around a few themes of its anti-foundationalism, fallibilism, and wants to decenter the subject. There's a focus on contingency and chance, as well as the pluralism. Can you help highlight how those relate to Levinas's ethics for us?
So, you know, I think very clearly Levinas's ethics has a similar anti-foundationalist stress, and that could be seen in terms of the kind of lack of bedrock or grounding in something like first principles or moral laws or any other original singular foundational source for ethical codes or behavior. And certainly decentering the subject, that's like classically Levinasian. And definitely plurality. So I think that one thing that's really important about Levinas's picture of subjectivity is that he is insistent that subjects emerge in plurality. Subjects emerge not individually, but together. And this in totality and infinity goes all the way back to the womb and the way in which subjects are never these kind of isolated, self-sufficient, free subjects, but in fact emerge in a space of dependency and a kind of co-emergence from the beginning. So that's three of the five aspects of American pragmatist ethics. The two others, fallibilism and contingency and chance, I think are a little bit less prevalent in Levinas. There's not a lot of, I mean, in a way, all of Levinas is about fallibilism because there are no ethical guarantees and there's no guarantees of becoming ethical or of doing the right thing or of knowing you've done the right thing. But there isn't the same, I think, you know, in American pragmatism, that's more a sense of the real openness to revision and the idea that truth is a work in progress. And I think that's a little bit different. There's just a different tenor between that and anything that's happening in Levinas. And while contingency and chance are important aspects of Levinas's thinking, I also think that the way in which that's foregrounded in certain brands of pragmatism is pretty different than anything we find in Levinas.
I want to go back just a little bit. We've mentioned phenomenology, and William James, when you bring him in, you're really trying to, in part, put together a pragmatist phenomenology in some sense. And William James can be conceived of as a precursor to phenomenology or a proto-phenomenologist. What exactly is phenomenology, and how common is it for people to view James as a precursor to phenomenology? Or how fair is that assessment?
Phenomenology is a branch of philosophy, but really it's tied to a specific kind of philosophical method that is often traced back to Husserl. And so in a broad user-friendly description of phenomenology, phenomenology entails the close description of phenomena as they arise for consciousness. So what this means practically is that when you're reading phenomenology, you're going to encounter lots of detail, lots of direct observation, and lots of description. And Husserl was interested in part in this kind of methodology because it would secure a more scientific foundation for philosophy, kind of bring it closer in line with the ideal of scientific discourse that was so prevalent in his own time period. James and Husserl overlap quite a bit. They're only about a decade apart in their lifespan, but James is older. And his Principles of Psychology, which gets published in 1890, I really do think of as a important precursor to phenomenology. And so, for instance, Husserl had a very intently marked up copy of the Principles of Psychology in his own library, even though he barely mentions James ever in any of his writings. So there's a lot more overlap between American and European continental philosophy than people, I think, like to admit or talk about. But this is also just part of philosophers wanting to be unique and the sole source of their own ideas. But I think in the Principles of Psychology, there's a lot of things that are precursors to full-blown phenomenology, including James's really intent attention to lived experience and his concern with mind and with kind of investigating the way in which mind and consciousness inflect and affect our experiences of everything else. His interest in time and what it means to be in time. And then maybe most explicitly, his very many descriptions in the Principles of Psychology of experience as being kind of suffused with things that go beyond what we immediately right here and now either are thinking or observing. So he uses the language of fringes and horizons and penumbras throughout the Principles of Psychology to express that kind of nebulous sort of overshading of experience that is always tending into the next thing or just beyond the focus of one's attention. And those are very deeply rooted phenomenological insights.
In your book, Levinas and James, you build up toward discussions around poetry and painting. And it seems Levinas has this very complicated relationship with art. On one hand, he's very critical and he'll be critical of art for art's sake. And he'll say there's no such thing as an ethical piece of art. And then he'll use art as examples to help communicate his ethics. Can you help us understand a little bit of what's going on in his relationship with art and the role it plays in his ethics?
One thing that I really have enjoyed in trying to read Levinas and James together a little bit is the total sort of abandon and embrace that William James has with respect to art and art in all kinds of media and literature. And with Levinas, it's definitely much more complicated. I think part of what you see Levinas reacting to is a kind of post-war embrace of modernism and abstract expressionism that seems to suggest that the unspeakable or that which cannot be looked at head on can be expressed in this other way through abstraction and through it kind of modernist devices. And so, you know, I think Levinas is uncomfortable with the idea that art might provide some kind of ultimate reckoning or consolation. And I think this is really complicated in Levinas. I think Jill Robbins is a scholar who I think has done really terrific work on this issue, because part of what's so tricky in Levinas is that his own work is so poetic and has so many artistic aspects to it at the same time that he's really critical of art in different moments of his writing for being evasive or for not being straightforward enough or for not having to do with ethics. And I think that's really the primary thing that he is concerned about. He doesn't think that making a masterpiece, some artistic masterpiece, is in any way of the same order as ethical action or responsibility. So it's not that art is unethical. For Levinas, it's just aethical. It's outside the question of ethics or not ethics. It's just something else entirely. So, you know, that means that it's really just not this, it's not a central concern of Levinas's. And again, thinking about him in his own historical context, he is writing also at the time of figures like Sartre and other French existentialists who are really fully kind of embracing the possibility of eroding any distinction between philosophy and other literary genres or literary forms, and really finding space in the art world for new kinds of expression. So you see Levinas kind of having this knee-jerk, like, we must sober up and we must remain serious and remain committed to ethics kind of mentality. But I think it's very complicated, because I think he is, whether he likes it or not, engaged in a lot of artistic activity himself in his writing. And I think it's a site of real complication in his philosophy to think about the status of art and the artist and artworks. It's not as easy as just saying he doesn't like it and he doesn't want it. It's much more complicated than that.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us, teaching us a little bit about Levinas. It is my hope that it causes us to reconsider our list of rules and think a little bit more ambiguously and deeply about our ethics. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.